Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of Radcast. This month, we're going to be discussing one of the more contentious issues facing the healthcare service today, and that's the role of physician associates and other medical associate professionals in patient care. We're delighted to be joined by someone who's gaining a reputation for sticking his head above the parapet when it comes to this issue, and that's Dr. David Little. So thank you for joining us, David. Can you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. So my name's David Little. I'm a consultant radiologist at the Royal United Hospital in Bath. From a clinical perspective, I do mainly nuclear medicine and a bit of head and neck. I'm also head of school in Severn for radiology. So I have a training role, and I also dabble in some college work. I sit on the specialty training board at the RCR, and I'm also involved in recruitment as well as lead for SD3 recruitment.
Nice. So we've been meaning to asked to speak to you for a while now about the whole MAP debate, because you've been very vocal about it on social media. But then a couple of weeks ago, your open letter to the RCR about DMC PA regulation started doing the rounds in our radiology WhatsApp groups, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners signed it because it ended up with over 1,200 signatures. So at that point, we were like, we've got to get this man on as an absolute priority. So yeah, thank you for agreeing to speak to us about such a topical issue.
No problem.
And so let's start with that open letter then, because it was a really bold move. How did it come about?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. As you say, I've always been a kind of advocate for what I believe, and particularly in medicine around kind of future generations of medics and specifically radiologists these days. And as you say, I've been quite open about this and other topics on social media. In terms of this specific topic, I saw a document from the GMC around some of the proposed specifics of regulation of MAPs, and I was just astonished by what it said. So one of the things being that they had planned to give PAs and AAs the same 7-digit number that they give to all doctors. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't believe that they were even considering doing that. And also that they were essentially devolving kind of the decisions about scope of practice to colleges and trusts, which, as we all already know from social media, has already led to a bit of a wild west of different approaches. And that was really what prompted me to act. I thought, I need to do something here. I don't exactly know what that is. I could just tweet about it, which is what I would typically do. But I thought, actually, why don't I write to the RCR, which is something I've done on other topics. And then I showed it to a few colleagues and friends, and they were like, oh, that's a really good letter. We'd quite like to sign it too. And it kind of grew from there, really.
Mm. Right, so you were originally going to just write to them yourself?
I was. That was the original plan, yeah.
Interesting.
How much thought did you give it before deciding to write it?
A little bit. I tend to find that actually writing something from gut feeling is sometimes a good idea. So I kind of wrote it shortly after reading that document from the GMC, really. It's then usually wise to kind of sleep on that, particularly if you're sending emails, and I'm sure we've all made that mistake, sending emails that we regret. So I kind of wrote it, I then slept on it for a little bit, and then I, as I say, sent it to a couple of colleagues who I would consider kind of moderates, if you like, not kind of radicals. And then it became clear that actually this wasn't just my opinion, this reflected the opinions of lots of other people.
So no one said, oh, this is a bit too hot of a topic, David.
One or two people would say that, but that hasn't stopped me too much in the past. So,
but generally, when you were consulting other people, then the response was positive.
It was, yeah.
So, I mean, this kind of thing isn't an isolated incident, and we can discuss some more cases later on. But what do you think about the DMC's motivations here? Conspiracy theorists might say that it's a deliberate attempt to blur the boundaries between doctors and PAs.
Yeah, honestly here, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but I do find it a little bit odd that anyone ever thought it would be a good idea to give physician associates the same 7-digit number as they give to doctors. Not just because it kind of creates confusion for both patients and medics, but also it's just going to stoke the fire of what has been quite a heated debate, as you touched on. And so, maybe it is part of a wider aim to kind of maybe weaken the medical workforce or cheapen the medical workforce. I don't know. It just seems all very odd to me.
Yeah, it just seems like such an avoidable own goal if that wasn't their intention to sort of do anything slightly underhand. Just a lack of insight of what the debate is like at the moment.
It really does.
And what, when you wrote the letter, did you have any kind of achievements in mind, or was it just a case of putting it out there and stirring up debate?
Yeah. I think, well, when I first wrote it, I was going to send it myself, as I said, and then it became clear that some other people wanted to sign it, and I thought maybe it might get, I don't know, 50 signatures, and that'd be an achievement and would show that actually this is something that other people do care about. But I was just blown away by the response and the strength of feeling. What I wanted it to actually achieve, I wanted the RCR to kind of sit up and listen to members and fellows and realize that this isn't just some social media furore. This is something that is actually on the minds of all their members and fellows. And I wanted them to do something publicly about it rather than just being silent. I mean, maybe they are kind of advocating in the background, but I wanted them to go a bit stronger and advocate for their members and fellows, which I think is the role of the college. And actually, to their credit, they have done that a little bit, and they've come out quite strongly against PAs having a 7-digit GMC number, slightly more strongly than I might have expected.
Yeah, they have issued a response now, haven't they?
They have, yes. So the letter went in on kind of Friday afternoon, and then with the increase in signatures, I sent it in again on Monday with 1,227, I think, off the top of my head. And then there was a brief statement on Tuesday, which kind of said they were thinking about this and thanking people for their engagement, and that they had some concerns about the 7-digit GMC number issue. And then they've subsequently come out with a stronger statement following some discussions at faculty board, I understand, which is very strong on that 7-digit GMC number issue, which is good. It's somewhat vague on the other issue around regulation and scope of practice and what the college's role in that might be, but I think it's a start.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you know what their stance was originally? Do you think your letter changed their stance, or that's what they were thinking to start with, and maybe you just forced their hand to be a bit more vocal about it?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think if you look at some of the newsletters that Kath Halliday, the president, had sent out, I think you can notice a gradual change in tone. There was one a few months ago, which was actually, I thought, slightly dismissal of the whole thing and saying that it was largely a social media issue and that we all needed to work together closely. But then a month or so later, I think the same kind of newsletter did acknowledge that this is actually an issue and that people do have strong feelings. So I think it was on the radar of the college. In fact, I know it was, because I bumped into Kath Halliday a couple of weeks ago and we had a talk about this. But I think what it did do was demonstrate really how strong the feeling was amongst members and fellows.
And what about the GMC? Have they responded?
Yeah, I've not seen anything to date on the GMC, on the specific issues that were included in the letter. I know there was a very firm letter from the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges on the topic, particularly of the 7-digit GMC number thing. And I'm led to believe that the RCR were important contributors to that. Whether that would have happened if there hadn't been this letter and kind of overwhelming sense of feeling, I don't know. I mean, maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't.
The GMC kind of seemed like this faceless organization that we only interact with when we do something wrong or when they want to implement some whole-scale changes. So I don't know, are you expecting much from them? Do you think they'll be like, okay, radiologists or doctors aren't happy with this, we're going to row back?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I hope so, particularly on this issue around regulation. I mean, it's certainly still a hot topic. And there are a lot more issues to discuss other than just the kind of specifics of regulation. I think they are going to have to row back on this 7-digit GMC number thing, because I just think that there is no appetite amongst not just to radiologists, oncologists, but medics more widely for that to happen. I think it's dangerous, frankly.
Yeah.
It's interesting that this discussion is happening now when physician associates have been in roles for at least 2 years. Mm. So they have been part of the workforce for a little while, and it's now that they've, you know, you'd think that it would be something that would be part of the plan to implement rather than something that is effectively an afterthought.
It doesn't seem like there necessarily is a plan. It seems like a lot of the decision makers are kind of feeling things out as they go along, because the scope does seem to be changing with time in terms of what they're able to do.
And I think that's because no one is really defining that scope. And I think some people were hoping that the GMC with regulation might do that, but they seem to be moving away from that. And as I say, seem to want to devolve it to colleges and to individual trusts, but that just creates such a wide variety of what they are doing.
Mm.
It's just not going to help the situation.
Even the fact that it's only now that they're deciding who's going to regulate them, I would have thought that would have been something that would have been decided from the start.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so there was a consultation about that a few years ago, which, I mean, I knew nothing about. And you may have seen some of the discussions about that on social media. That was when it was decided that it would be the GMC rather than, for example, the HCPC that do other practitioners.
Mm.
Whether that was, again, it seems difficult to imagine that there was kind of any underhand tactic there that they were trying to disguise it. I think it's just the fact that it is now much more visible. I think the workforce plan, people have seen that actually these roles were a big part of the future workforce plan, and that has brought it to people's attention. Likewise with social media and lots of examples being flagged. And actually, I admit, I mean, I probably had my head in the sand about this until about 6 months or so ago, and maybe thought actually this isn't really an issue for radiology. It's something that might affect other specialties. But actually, I think having thought about it and looked at it, I think it does go much wider than our own individual specialties.
Mm. I mean, how is this different to the skills mix that has been accepted, embraced in radiology for a long time? Do you think there is any difference between that and sort of the PA debate?
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think in many ways, we are way ahead of the curve on this because, as you say, we've had skills mix and reporting radiographers and sonographers for a long time. I think it is slightly different. I think that part of the workforce is trained in imaging and it's about them developing new skills within the same kind of sphere rather than being a whole new workforce with 2 years of training who are then potentially able to do anything, it seems. Mm-hmm. So I think there are differences. And also, I think there's a much broader spectrum of opinion on things like reporting radiographers. Some of the same issues probably do apply, things like scope creep and should they be doing plain films, should they be doing cross-sectional imaging, which is a whole debate that we could get into. I think it is a little bit different.
Yeah, there are lots of sort of debates you can get into about that. Very true. You talk about scope creep, like you have been vocal about calling a lot of that stuff out, sort of tweeting about various job adverts. So I think there was an advert a few months ago about a consultant radiographer job advert where it said that they were expected to work autonomously at the level of a consultant radiologist. And I think the trust ended up, after it was sort of pointed out to them that wasn't, that it was inappropriate, they ended up taking down the job advert and apologising. But you do have evidence of that scope creep happening even in radiology.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, consultant radiographers have existed for years, and particularly in areas like breast radiology, who've had major staffing issues. And I've got nothing against those roles. I think within a defined and limited scope of practice, they're actually a really important part of the workforce. But equally, they are not the equivalent of a consultant radiologist. They haven't done FRCR. They're not reporting the CT chest abdo-pelvis or reviewing the PET CT for the MDT. They're working with a defined scope of practice. And I think it's that equivalence issue for me, which is something that needs to be ironed out a little bit. And actually, I know the college do pay attention to what happens on social media. They have seen some of these job adverts, and they have themselves been getting in touch with trusts to discuss that and just make sure that things aren't being misadvertised or misrepresented.
I think all of this, it feeds into kind of a wider narrative that there is some sort of conflict between doctors and MAPs. And it does seem like it's becoming increasingly heated, particularly on social media. So do you think that social media has a benefit or more of a toxic influence on the debate?
Yeah, that's another very good question. I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I've been using Twitter or X, whatever it's called these days, for the best part of, I don't know, 14, 15 years probably. And I've used other social media as I've grown up. It's kind of been something that I've, a thing that I've done. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great. I think it does provide a platform where there isn't much of a hierarchy and people can interact with leaders and people that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. I think it's a great platform for sharing of ideas and thoughts, but it probably isn't a great place for nuanced debate. And some of these debates are very nuanced. I think that there's been lots of anonymous accounts, which again have pros and cons. I think it has given people an outlet to raise concerns and flag things. But equally, when you're anonymous, it's quite easy to overstep that line. And that's one of the reasons why I have always on social media not been anonymous, because I think that helps me to self-regulate and not say something that would be unprofessional or too personal or that does cross those lines. And I think that some of the personal attacks and issues that have been seen on social media are not ideal, and they probably undermine the argument at the end of the day.
Yeah, definitely.
But I still think social media is the pros for me currently still outweigh the cons.
Have you ever posted something and then sort of thought about it and maybe deleted it or thought, oh, that might have been a bit over the line?
It depends who's drawing the line, I suppose. I try to tread that line quite carefully for a variety of reasons. I mean, everyone's scared of the GMC, as you've said, and I don't want to find myself in a meeting with no coffee with the medical director or getting fired. So I try and tread that line carefully, and I don't think personally that I've ever crossed it. I've never had to delete anything, and I tend to try and stand by what I've said. And I think I'm able to do that because I do try and think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think the tension is worse anyway, just because there's doctors are already sort of pissed off about so many other issues at the moment. Like we're in the midst of strikes over pay and working conditions. So everyone's got their guard up. So people sort of react very strongly to any perceived attempts to sort of undermine us, even if they're not even real. It's sort of like an immune response at the moment.
Definitely.
I think that's really true. I mean, doctors are just generally angry about lots of things at the moment, which in some ways is great. At least people are engaged. For a long time, I think there's been a lot of apathy amongst not just doctors, but lots of people. And I think people are waking up to some of the things that are going on. And social media helps that a little bit. So the people that are engaged in social media see what is happening in other places and some of those job descriptions that you talked about. You never would have known about those without social media. So I think it does reflect deeper issues in the workforce. I think we are all very demoralized. The industrial action is having its toll. We are feeling undervalued generally. And I think that probably isn't helping. And I just saw something yesterday that Charlie Massey from the GMC had said that some of this PA and AA debate was related to the ongoing industrial dispute. And I think he's partly right.
Yeah.
I think that's valid.
Yeah, there's probably more people who previously would have been apathetic who are now more vocal.
Yeah.
And I think that, it just all comes down to what the baseline mood is amongst doctors.
Definitely.
So before the MAP debate started heating up, you also came onto our radar when you ran for RCR president. What was that experience like?
Yeah, that was It was really interesting. I mean, I passionately believe in the role of Royal Colleges in advocating for both members and fellows and for patients. And I wanted to show that you didn't have to be someone who's kind of peri-retirement or at the end of their career to run for a senior college officer role. And I was partly inspired by Hannah Tharmalingam, who was oncology vice president at a very early stage of her career. So that was kind of one of the main reasons for running. And I always also wanted to emphasize as part of that process that younger consultants and trainees are very much the future of the college and our specialties. And I wanted to make that part of the conversation. So I thought it'd be really interesting to run. I mean, despite kind of getting myself into these situations sometimes, I don't really see myself as necessarily a natural kind of leader. But yeah, it was, I thought I could bring something a little bit different to the role, maybe. Whether it would have worked or not, who knows.
Did you go into it thinking that you had a strong chance of winning?
I mean, I knew I was an outsider. Equally, when the candidate list came out with 9 different names on it, anything could happen at that stage. In some ways, it was easier for me to run knowing that I probably wouldn't win. Because
like Trump,
in some ways, if I had it, it would have been challenging, I think. I obviously did my research beforehand, spoke to current and previous presidents and lots of other stakeholders, and actually in some ways it would have been quite difficult if I'd won. The role of president is basically a 3 to 4 day per week unpaid job.
Right.
Which is quite something, actually, when you think about it. And so you need to have the support of your trust, potentially, to give you some extra PAs to do that role, which I did, although I think that's possibly because they thought I wouldn't win. it would have been a massive pay cut. And I think that's probably one of the other reasons why people only do these roles towards the end of their career, because they're at a stage where they perhaps can afford to drop a few sessions and do something a bit different. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I wouldn't have gone into it if I didn't think I had a chance of winning, but I knew it was always a bit of a long shot.
Can anyone apply to run, or do you need to be nominated by a certain number of people?
So anyone, any fellow from the UK is currently allowed to run in the presidential election. For the presidential election, you need to have 4 fellows that kind of that nominate you. But ultimately, it's kind of for an individual to decide whether they want to run. And most people will be able to find 4 fellows that will back them.
And then in terms of the voting process, is it just all of the fellows get a vote? I can't remember. I think I did vote.
I hope you voted for me.
I can't remember who for. Yeah, definitely voted for you. So everyone gets a vote, and then sounds like you probably slightly relieved you didn't win in the end.
Yeah, so in terms of the process, it's a vote amongst UK fellows only at the moment. It's a single transferable vote system. And actually, one of the debates during the election amongst some of the candidates was whether, for example, members should also be able to vote, which I felt very strongly that they should, because they are an important part of the college, and that they are the future of the college. Just because they haven't passed the exam yet doesn't mean that their opinion is any less valid. And there was actually some broad agreement amongst some of the other candidates that agreed on that, but I don't quite know where the college are up to in making those changes.
Do you intend to run again?
Oh yeah, that's a good question. I knew you were going to ask me that. At the moment, I don't feel like I have any plans to run for president again, probably more for kind of logistical reasons, really. As I say, it would be a significant pay cut and a significant role to take on at this stage of my career. And actually, when I first drafted that letter, I thought, should I say at this stage, kind of rule myself out, because that's not what this was about. And I deliberately took my name off the bottom of that letter, because I didn't want it just to be associated with me. I wanted all of the signatures to be listed in alphabetical order. Whereas if I was going to run again, it probably would have made sense for my name to be on the bottom of it to kind of get it more recognized, I suppose. At the moment, I don't know. I mean, I definitely want to be involved in the college going forward because I feel that it does have a really important role to play, whether that's as president or something else. Who knows? I feel like the thing was when I ran before, I was very much still at the beginning of my consultant career, and I was bringing something a little bit different. As I kind of get more towards the middle of my consultant career, that unique selling point maybe changes a little bit. So yeah, I don't know, lots to think about at the moment. No plans, but who knows what will happen in 2 years' time.
Do you feel you can perhaps have a greater impact as a rebellious voice from the outside, holding the college to account?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think, as you said, when I got the call to say that I hadn't won, it was very much a mixture of relief and a little bit of disappointment. Obviously, if you're going to run in something like that, you always want to kind of think that you have a chance of winning. But there definitely was a sense of relief, partly because it wasn't going to completely upend my life and dominate the next few years. But also because of that thing, I think you're right. It is easier as an outsider. In my current roles, I can play the role of external critic, critical friend, or whatever you want to call it. And doing that from the outside is much easier than doing it from the inside. And I think this is one of the things I said to Kath when I met her for the first time a few weeks ago. I would have actually found it really difficult. And I think I might have resigned in protest 3 or 4 times by now. because I get that when you're in that kind of role as a senior leader, you are speaking for the organization as a whole rather than just your individual opinions. And I think getting that balance is really difficult. It's not something I think I would have been very good at. I think I might have got myself into trouble. And I get it. If we take the MAP example, if the college come out against the GMC saying this absolutely must not happen, then that threatens what is probably quite an important working relationship between the RCR and the GMC. Likewise, if the RCR were to come out and say to government, you absolutely must get back round the table with the BMA and negotiate to solve the industrial action. Again, then the college are potentially burning bridges with the government, and what the college should be doing is influencing governments on policy. And if that kind of role is diminished in some way, then they're not going to be as effective. So I think it's really difficult to get that balance right. And I think I would have really struggled with it.
Yeah, you do have to be strategic. A lot of these new changes, they're not happening in isolation. They're part of much larger workforce issues. They're part of the long-term plan. So you can sort of kick and scream all you want, but physicians associates are here to stay. And as you say, they are an important part of the future workforce of the NHS. So,
yeah.
It's definitely good having prominent figures who aren't afraid to ask difficult questions and ruffle a few feathers. So that is good, and yeah, probably easier to do from the outside, as you say.
Yeah, definitely. I think a colleague once called me a kind of chief agitator, and that I think is one of the things I was trying to achieve. I wanted to agitate a little bit and challenge the status quo by running, because it's not something that someone of my stage of career would typically have done. And even by running and not winning, I hope I made that point and demonstrated that anyone can get involved in the college.
Yeah.
And the college is its members and fellows. And I would encourage any of your listeners, whatever stage of career, to get involved with the college and actually try and make changes from within.
Or from Dubai, Jamie.
Am I allowed to? Do you have to be in the UK to be able to vote? Or
you do? I think you have to be in the UK to vote currently. Again, that was another interesting topic of debate, because the college is increasingly global, and currently those people aren't eligible to vote, as far as I know. Again, that's something that I think probably should change.
Yeah, that's interesting. My membership fee is about half of what I was paying last year, though. So.
Yeah, silver linings.
Okay, we also wanted to touch on radiology recruitment, because you sit on the RCR recruitment subcommittee.
That's correct.
And many of our listeners are foundation doctors who are trying to get into radiology. So I wonder if we can give them some tips within the rules, of course. What role do you play in the recruitment process?
So as you said, I sit on a recruitment kind of subcommittee or steering group. And I was on that when I was a training program director. They wanted representation from across the UK. And as is often the case, when you kind of turn up to a meeting, you end up having to do stuff because you're in the room. And I got nominated to lead ST3 recruitment last year, and I'm doing the same thing this year. But I'm also involved in the other discussions around kind of ST1 recruitment and things. So that's the role that I currently hold.
Yeah, the ST3 recruitment was a new thing they brought in a couple of years ago, wasn't it? What was the why did they decide to do that all of a sudden?
I think it's part of every effort to increase the radiology workforce because we are so short of radiologists. That said, the kind of the training pool is all one pool, so potentially you are diluting the numbers of ST1s that you can take. But there are lots of people in the either currently working in the UK as fellows who've maybe done some of the exams abroad, who ultimately might want to CSER in radiology. But that process certainly historically has been a very arduous process. And many of those people actually applied for ST3 recruitment because they thought that would be a quicker way than CSERing to get a kind of CCT or equivalent. So I think it's just an effort to again, do everything that the college could do to try and get people to apply for radiology.
I mean, looking at the ST1 recruitment, the number of applicants has ballooned over the last few years. I think it was about 3,000 last year, which gives a competition ratio of about 9 or 10 to 1. So it must be quite demanding for the college to manage all this increased workload.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really difficult. Radiology is probably for its size, one of the most popular specialties with about 9-to-1 ratio. And I've been reflecting on this a lot recently about how should we select the best candidates to be radiologists. And I've reflected a bit openly on social media about that as well. And we had some really interesting discussion and suggestions. I think that that's where the MSRA comes in. Now, I hate the MSRA. Particularly the SJT part of it, I think it's a terrible way of selecting. However, I don't currently have an immediate practical alternative that would allow us to reduce from 3,000 applicants, say, to roughly 700, which is what we have the capacity to interview. So it's a kind of necessary evil in some ways, I think, at the moment.
And it's established and it's been validated. So
correct.
I suppose it's easy to just say, okay, well, we'll use that as well, as opposed to having to come up with your own complete fresh system.
Exactly. I mean, some people suggested maybe a radiology-specific exam, but actually designing a robust and reliable assessment is a really difficult job. And actually, it's a huge job. And most of these roles are unpaid. And so getting people to do that would be very difficult. So I mean, there are things that we could do, and I've tried to advocate for, is maybe dropping the SJT part of it and just using the medical knowledge assessment, which I think is perhaps a bit more valid. But I think we are slightly stuck with the MSRA at the moment, unless anyone's got any bright ideas amongst your listeners about a better alternative.
Or their top 10 Radcast trivia facts that they've learned. Podcast. Show real commitment. But you are moving in the right direction. Like this year, the SRAs are only worth 20% of the overall ranking, I think, whereas in the past it's been like a third. So the SRA portfolio and interview have all been equally weighted. And this year, the interview is worth 50% of the final ranking. So I think that is good because it obviously puts more emphasis on the interview where people can really demonstrate their like passion for radiology and their communication skills. So I think that's good. Was the reason for that change just because you're all sort of in agreement that there's too much emphasis on the SRA?
I think that, so you're right. Last year, the MSRA was actually 40% of the final mark, and then it was 30% for your 30% portfolio. So it was a huge part of the final mark. I mean, it is such an important part of the process because you have to get over that bar anyway to get to the interview stage. So yeah, we've discussed this a lot, and every meeting I go to, I kind of say how I hate the MSRA, and then people challenge that and say, well, what else are we going to do? And so we kind of talked about diluting it, and I'm really pleased that we have been able to do that. I mean, I want to just scrap it completely from that part of the kind of final mark, or at very least get rid of the SJT bit and maybe just keep the knowledge bit, but I'm told that's not currently possible. So this was a bit of a compromise, I think. And actually, to be fair, someone made a good point that candidates are putting a lot of effort into sitting this exam, so it probably should be a part of the final mark. And I think 20% is probably reasonable as to where that sits.
Have they looked at the correlation between people's SRA marks and how they actually do in radiology, either in exams or just generally?
Yeah, so I'm told there is some evidence that the MSRA performance correlates with kind of interview scores and I don't know in terms of the portfolio scores, but my counter to that is you're only looking there at the people that have actually got over the bar to get to interview. What if all the best radiologists are amongst the candidates that don't get over that MSRA bar? I think it's a slightly biased way of looking at it.
Just really unethical, really committed radiologists. Yeah. I just working in A&E. Okay, so if you had to maybe give three top tips for foundation trainees applying, what would they be?
Three top tips. Yeah, so at the moment, tip number one, I mean, the MSRA is still by far the most important part of the whole process because you have to get over that bar to get to interview and portfolio. So any time spent on preparing for that is probably time well spent, as much as you can actually prepare for it. I think that's probably where I'd put most of my effort. Number two, I think that you don't need to get full marks on the portfolio. So I was partly involved in the reworking of that portfolio last year, and the aim of that really was A, to reward the people that want to do radiology by giving people that had done stuff related to radiology slightly more marks, and B, to spread out the scores a little bit. So it used to be on a scale of 0 to 10, and the vast majority of candidates kind of got 7 or 8, so it didn't really differentiate anyone at all. It's now out of 0 to 45, so there is a much broader spread. But the important thing here is it looks slightly terrifying when you first read it, but you do not need to get full marks. There are opportunities for people who in each different area to score well. So the tip here is do your research, do your taste a week, spend a bit of time in radiology, demonstrate to your interviewers when you're being interviewed that you actually want to do radiology, because there are a number of people that apply for radiology as a bit of a backup, or they're not quite sure they want to do it, or they might be applying for something else. And what I'm looking for, both as a kind of person involved in recruitment as a head of school, is someone that is capable, but also someone that actually wants to do it, because that's that's important.
Yeah, I'd probably still get 15 out of 45 in the portfolio, and I'm a radiology consultant.
So yeah, I take that on board, and I think that is important for us to reflect on. I mean, I don't think I would have got in these days.
No, and no chance.
Maybe the college wish I hadn't. I don't know. So my final tip would be probably to maximize every opportunity you have to apply. So there are lots of people that either take an F3 or F4 or F5 or whatever. But I would be tempted, just because of the competition ratios, to apply straight after F2, even if you're thinking about doing an F3. And I say that because it sometimes takes people 2 or 3 attempts to get in. So if you are giving up those attempts to go and do something exciting, I don't know, you're in Australia or whatever, then so I would apply. Now, that does potentially put you in a slightly difficult position. If you're really keen to go to Australia, you apply and you get an offer. Do you take it? Oh, that's a difficult decision. But I think given the competition ratios as they are, you probably need to try and maximize your opportunities to get in.
Yeah. Take the post, then go for a fellowship.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that's some really, really good tips there. Just on the interview, because the format of that has changed this year. So for the past few years, it's actually been fair. It's been basically the same, hasn't it? Like 4 questions, which have not changed.
Yes, which is a frustration.
Yeah. I always found that a bit peculiar, because I mean, by last year, everyone knew exactly what was going to be asked, and I thought it must be really boring to be an interviewer and listening to the same rehearsed, choreographed answers.
Very much so. So there was a problem, and actually I wasn't involved in the interview side of things or the questions, but there was a plan to change them for last year. For some reason, that didn't happen. And that was a real shame. And actually, when you're interviewing, it's quite clear that people have prepped these questions. They've done the rounds of all the interview courses. And I think halfway through day one, someone posted them on Reddit, which, having the same questions year in, year out is just not really an option. So they are, barring some catastrophe, definitely changing for this year, which I think is really important.
Yeah. Do you think it will just go back to more of the old school style where you get asked a range of questions about radiology?
Yeah, I don't. So when I interviewed, there was a station where you had to prioritize requests, which I thought was quite good because that's kind of one of the roles that we do. And also, there was also, as part of that kind of practical station, you were given a selection of images, and I think you had to choose two that you had to talk a bit about. You didn't have to know much about the radiology, but you just had to kind of talk around them a little bit. So those practical stations worked quite well. And there, last year we had a similar prioritization station as part of the SD3 recruitment, which again discriminates, in my view, a little bit better than some of the more standard questions. I don't actually know exactly what the interview changes are going to be for this year, but personally, I would like to see a little bit more of that.
I remember I was given a breast cancer staging report that I had to critique. That was one of the, there was that, and then the prioritizing the requests. And then having to justify why I'd prioritize them in that way.
Yeah, provided you can come up with enough scenarios, I think that's definitely, it's more interesting, but is it as standardized? Some scenarios may be harder than others, so might be.
Yeah, again, I mean, recruitment, like, having been involved in it, is a really difficult topic. I mean, getting this right, I mean, you're never going to satisfy everyone, or maybe even anyone, because it's a difficult topic. And if you go through the recruitment process, you get your first choice job. I mean, it worked for you, but if you're one of the 2,300 that didn't get shortlisted, or however many thousand that don't get a job, then it potentially didn't work for you. And it's a really difficult thing to get right at all stages. And I do have some sympathy being involved in it. Equally, I think there are things that I say we, because I'm involved in it, can do to explain the process and some of the thinking behind it a little bit better than has been done historically. It's a challenge for sure.
Well, great. So I think that's everything we wanted to cover. So thank you very much for taking time to speak to us, and as I say, for not shying away from controversial issues. And please continue fighting the good fight on social media, because it's definitely making a difference.
Yeah, no problem. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. And I hope I haven't said anything too controversial, and I'm not going to be seeing the medical director anytime soon.
Thanks for listening, guys. We'll be back next month with another episode. And in the meantime, you can catch all of our previous episodes on the usual podcast platforms and at anchor.fm/radcast. And for more updates, check out our social media channels. So that's Radcast Academy on Twitter and Instagram. Bye.
Goodbye.